Let's go for the goal.
It should be all set.
Can you hear me from afar here like this?
Oh, yes. No, that's fine.
That picks them up good and tight, huh?
Yes.
Great.
Let's begin then by indicating that today is March 30th, 1995, and this is Jim Boning speaking with Keith McKinnon at the Holiday Inn in Scottsdale, I think.
You're in Scottsdale.
Okay. I know you were born in Condon, Oregon on Christmas Day in 1933, and that you subsequently received a B.S. degree in agricultural chemistry from Oregon State. I understand that why your interest in agriculture comes from your family background, but what about your interest in chemistry? Where did that develop?
I suppose it would be fair to say with a high school chemistry teacher named Lauren Studer, who was a graduate of, I believe, St. Olaf's College in Minnesota. And Studer introduced me as I was, I guess, a junior in high school to kind of the wonders and mysteries of chemistry, and I got fairly fascinated with that. I was not a, how would I describe it? I was not a good student in the sense that I didn't work very hard, but once I get curious about something, I'd get into it fairly deeply, and chemistry seemed easy for me and fun for me. So maybe that was part of
where was this school located?
That's Pendleton, Oregon.
Okay.
Pendleton High School, yeah, good question. One other thing that might be interesting as a matter of historical record, you mentioned I was born in Condon. Left there, by the way, at quite an early age, 4 years or something like that. Condon is a city of, I mean, on a really big day when it's festival time, it might be 50 people or 100 people. But in a normal time, it might be 30 or 40. And I discovered that one of the kids who went to school there, and I'm fuzzy now on exactly what years, but I think grade school and much of high school, was a guy named Linus Pauling. So here's this little town, I mean, we're talking little in fairly obscure parts of the United States, where a man of that caliber, you know, kind of went to school. Who knows? Maybe that inspired me some. I still have his, he was the class speaker when he graduated from Oregon State in 1922. And I'm the possessor of a copy of that speech to this day. Mm. You know, that was a lot of years before I was in Condon, or before I was a junior in high school, probably 30 years or something, 25. But maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. But Mr. Studer certainly did.
Did you have a lot of laboratory experience in that high school course?
Some laboratory work. Actually, it had, and again, this is a long time ago, but my memory is we had kind of the typical for the time chemistry laboratory. We had our little sinks, and we'd like probably every other kid in the history of the world take a little piece of sodium out from under the oil and throw it in the water, and you know, that kind of stuff. We did. It was not all books. We did do some real laboratory stuff.
You went to OSU in 51, I believe.
Right. And you've done your homework well, sir.
I understand that your father graduated from OSU, your grandfather graduated from OSU, so it was sort of preordained that this is where you were going to go.
As did my mother.
And your mother, too.
Yeah.
So which was unusual at that.
Yeah,
at that time.
I think so. It was a struggle for them. My dad learned to value college very much because I think partly because it took him so damn long to get through. He had to work a year and go a year and work a year and go a year, and of course that was right in the Depression. He was there in 32, graduated in 32, so he was right across the Depression with that. So that, it would not have been wise for me to fail to go to college. He was pretty emphatic about that.
I'm not sure what constitutes a degree in agricultural chemistry.
Yeah, it was a what was done, and I, maybe this is not entirely accurate, but I'll give you my perception at the time. I was in the School of Agriculture and taking chemistry.
Okay.
Agricultural chemistry was in the School of Chemistry. I wasn't a great student, but I, in the School of Agriculture, I was not bad. And they were trying to keep kids from leaving agriculture and going off into chemistry, so they developed a curriculum for upper class, junior, senior years, called Agricultural Technology, which basically was 100% electives for both years. I mean, you could take whatever the heck you wanted, kind of. And it permitted me to take all the chemistry and stay in the School of Agriculture. I didn't much care where I was, I guess, but a lot, I had a lot of freedom there, and I could take prodigious numbers of courses. I remember I typically took 19 credit hours a semester, term, I guess we call them, three terms, or I guess. So I did a lot of that stuff, and the degree in agricultural technology was, in fact, what I have. I say agricultural chemistry. Had all of the chemistry and a fair amount more of business-related stuff than you'd get in the chemistry curriculum. But it didn't have the German. The reason I didn't graduate, you know, with a B.S. in chemistry, because I ducked the German requirement, which wasn't the requirement in the agricultural technology. That was the fundamental difference. I thought, why the heck do I want to do German? I mean, we just won that war. Yeah, you know, I suppose that's what I thought. That was, by the way, quite a mistake. If I had anything to do over again as I were starting into, say, high school, maybe even back further now, I would get a second language. That's my single biggest regret from that. I didn't do it.
Were you aware of the Pauling legacy at OSU?
Yeah.
When you were the student?
I was. I, Pauling was at Caltech and doing wondrous things. You know, remember, I was at OSU about the time that Watson and Crick did their wondrous magic, and Pauling was heavily into that, as I'm sure you know. So he was a Caltecher and hadn't maybe developed as much of a, well, how would I say it? His mind was occupied with other things than Oregon State. And it was in his later years that he warmed to that, and that became a big deal, which is now quite a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, every February 28th from now on will be Linus Pauling Day in the state of Oregon. Just
really?
As an example.
Okay.
Yeah, by proclamation. And the last one was the first one. And I had the high privilege of having dinner with Sir Francis Crick.
Oh, marvelous.
There, you know, kind of to celebrate the event. And Crick gave a lecture about Pauling and all of that. So that's become a major. And I was aware, but it wasn't as big a thing when I was in college.
Mm-hmm.
But awareness, yeah. I mean, it was, the chemistry department took some significant pride in the fact that it had a Nobel laureate who was one of their undergraduate students.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he'd won his second Nobel Prize. That was a Peace Prize, and that came much later.
Yes, yeah, that would have been, I think, in the 60s. Somewhere.
Yeah, but he remains today the only individual to have two unshared Nobels.
Mm-hmm.
So you hear that a lot when you're in court.
I was interested in what you said about the this degree program, which had a business component to it also.
Yeah, I it was unclear to me whether I would be best served trying to spend my life in a white lab coat or whether I wasn't maybe even competent to do that. I mean, I was learning that there are some pretty smart kids in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I was having to work a little bit, and some of them were kind of blowing by me. So I thought to myself, ooh, you may not be all that brilliant in the research business. Maybe you better learn a little bit about the rest of the world. So I consciously took some business courses. You know, it always seemed to me that almost without exception, wherever I ended up, I mean, you can take a bunch of fields. You can take law or medicine or agriculture, or you kind of pick one. Having a basic degree and knowledge base in chemistry, I thought was going to be a pretty good deal for that. If I were going to be a business person, as long as it was in the chemical-related industry, I thought that would be good. So I concluded for myself, and have advised all the kids I get a chance to advise since, nothing wrong with it. You don't have to go be a PhD and chase Nobel Prizes. You can go be a chemical peddler or go, you know, do something else. Mm-hmm. Go be CEO of General Electric. Mm-hmm. As well, was either a chemical engineer or a chemist. I mean, so, and there are a lot of ways to use that. And I tumbled early to the fact it might be smart to have a hole card.
Okay, great. Did you do any kind of research as an undergraduate, or was it strictly coursework?
No, I spent one of my summers, I mean, my three summers between my college years were kind of interesting. One of them I drove a Caterpillar pulling a combine, and one of them I was a craps dealer in Reno, Nevada, and one of them, the last one, I spent at the Oregon State Agricultural Experiment Station doing chemistry for a fellow named Dr. Virgil Freed, F-R-E-E-D, who was head of the Ag Chemistry Department there, and he invited me to spend the summer at the laboratory doing stuff. And that was probably, in retrospect, one of those little chance things that had a huge impact on where I ended up, because I worked on a method for the detection of 2,4-D residues. Mm. At the time, 2,4-D was big herbicide. And today's sophisticated techniques for detection weren't exactly available. And darn if we didn't discover one using something called chromatropic acid, of all things, which would detect at, for then, pretty low levels and get a nice purple color and a Klett spectrophotometer. And so we were, I mean, this was an exciting summer because we kind of got that done. We got it in the Journal of Ag and Food Chem very quickly because everybody was looking for that kind of a thing. So, I mean, for a college undergraduate, it wasn't exactly Sir Francis Crick discovering DNA or something, but it was a kind of a development, and Dow was a big 2,4-D producer, and it kind of caught their eye. So I suspect that's one of the reasons that they were anxious, maybe the wrong word, but prepared to interview me when they came to Oregon State.
How would you characterize the chemistry department at OSU at that time?
You know, in the context of chemistry departments in other universities, as I know them now, I would say it was mediocre to adequate, not top tier. I feel differently, by the way, about the chemical engineering department there, which I believe is one of the best in the country. Chemistry, I would say, was a mid-range department. Lots of, even in those days, foreign graduate students who were teaching some labs and stuff that were a little hard to understand. And that may be too harsh an appraisal, because I wasn't nearly as motivated until toward the end of my... I was relatively immature in college. I would say perfectly capable of getting very good grades, but not particularly interested in getting very good grades. I discovered a lot of things like fun, girls, and, you know, all that stuff immature kids kind of do. And it was only the last year or so, a couple of years maybe, that I kind of snapped out of that and got serious about all that stuff. Then I started to get more from the university than I had before, and that's probably more my fault than its fault. I think it was perfectly capable of teaching me a lot more than I learned. So, but I wouldn't agree. I would still have to say kind of an average. That reminds me of another funny thing that I probably shouldn't tell you, but I will. The seven or eight of us who were the senior executives at Dow, one time we're sitting around reviewing the criteria we use for interviewing prospective employees, science qualified for that employee. We had all this stuff, grade points and all this stuff. And one of us, maybe me, said, okay, guys, now, no baloney. How many of us, under these criteria, would have been eligible to be interviewed? And the answer, I believe, was one of the seven. We were going to do it to ourselves with all this. And it was kind of an eye-opener about how things have changed and things have changed. But I would not be an interviewee in today's schedule. I don't know whether Paul might have been. He wasn't part of this group. He'd left by then. Paul probably was. He probably had pretty good grades. Some of the rest of us weren't so red hot there. So I mean, maybe there's a message in that about what works. Mm-hmm. But
did that last summer experience whet your appetite for research?
It certainly whetted my appetite for chemistry. And I think it's fair to say the answer to that is yeah, we were quite successful with something that had been a fairly intractable problem for others. And I guess I thought, yeah, this would be fun. I can't remember. I don't think I ever seriously considered applying for graduate school. I think, how would I phrase it? I was broke, and maybe subconsciously at least smart enough to know I wasn't going to be competitive with the great minds of the world in chemistry. And here were some guys offering me a job with a chemical company I liked. So frankly, that option never occurred to me. And in those days, you know, BS chemists could find pretty good jobs, and they weren't, if you will, just a pair of hands for a PhD somewhere or something. They were doing our own stuff, so I just went off and did it.
I understand that your father, Rex, said there were two companies that were worthy of consideration. One was Dow, and the other was Stauffer. Just remembered now who it was that I talked to in Key Largo, and it was H. Barkley Morley.
Oh, you did, huh?
So it finally came back.
Yeah, Bark and I are good friends. We see each other every summer. And we have nice visits every summer in a very nice place on a nice patio and relive some of our past transgressions and glories or whatever.
And you, I think you've already described why you selected Dow over Stauffer in your interview with Ned.
Yeah, I mentioned my dad's comments about Dow Corning, I think. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably pretty well in there.
So you started at Dow in 1955, title of research chemist, and a special assignment.
I suspect that research chemist was probably today chemist one or something. Mm-hmm. Entry-level chemist is what it was. Research chemist sounds classier. I was chemist one.
Okay. One of the things I'd like to do as we follow through your career here at Dow is to sort of focus on the research environment as you experienced it.
Be glad to do that.
So let me ask what it was like when you started there in this particular group. And as I understand it, this was you had a number of short assignments that were involved in.
Yeah, I went through a training program, which was a number of 6-week assignments in different departments. The rationale for that was, let's see if we can find a good fit between your capabilities and your interests and a department's receptivity. So a lot of us went through that.
Okay. Where were you first?
I was at an agricultural experiment station in South Haven, Michigan.
Okay. What was your reaction to here you are coming out with a BS degree, you've done some good research, you've got a paper published, and now you're at a good chemical company. What was your reaction to these early assignments?
Yeah, first of all, the program was terrific, because I got a chance to learn a lot in different places. That first one, and I may have mentioned this to Ned, that first one was a particularly interesting assignment, because there's one thing I knew a fair amount about. It was agricultural chemical experimentation. I'd even lived on an agricultural experiment station. So I was a great trial to the folks running that agricultural experiment station in South Haven, because by my own modest admission, I knew essentially everything and was in a position to teach them a lot, you know. And I'm sure they thought, oh, what have I got? What do we got here? You know. But they were patient. And as a matter of fact, years later, that was 55, so it would have been 35 years later, I had the pleasure of presenting a 50-year pin. A guy had worked 50 years to a guy named John Davidson, who was the guy running that station when I came there that first day. So, I mean, it all comes around, and John and I have become very good friends since. But I know I was a trial to him then, although I'm not sure he ever quite said that. My reaction was, this outfit knows what they're doing. They're doing some good stuff. I'm going to like this. But again, I was at an agricultural experiment station, and I wasn't in the big plant. I learned some things very quickly. I remember driving from South Haven to Dow's Midland Division, called Midland Division. And I was smoking a cigarette as I came up to the guard gate, you know, to go in. I learned a lot about safety rules. That guard carved me up big time. And that was just what he should have done. Mm-hmm. So I'm out. It was fun.
Where else were you?
What other special projects?
Right.
Yeah, I worked on... I went from that experiment station to a organic synthesis laboratory where I was working on a new synthesis for 2-methyl-4-chlorophenoxyacetic acids instead of 2,4-dichlor, MCP that was called. Worked there for a while. I did a project. I think one of the great things that every chemist ought to get a chance to do is work on the fundamental problem of soil stabilization. Everybody wants to stabilize soil, and you got about 1 cent per million tons to do it with, so it's an impossible problem. Nobody can do it for the economics or nothing. I had a project like that. I worked on coating citrus. And I believe, boy, it's a little fuzzy now. We were coating citrus for the purpose of maintaining its freshness and retarding the rate of spoilage. And then I had this project in Dow's Western Division working on water-soluble polymer technology for flocculation, solid-liquid separation. I believe those were the projects. I believe I have now named them all.
Okay. How would you characterize the research supervisors you were working for?
Highly variable. First of all, they were inherently arranged. There were some relatively young new ones, and there were some old hands who'd been around forever. And we're talking the mid-50s, of course, I would describe them as universally competent, interested in what they were doing, relatively unskilled in human resource management and interpersonal relations and all that. I mean, everybody was flying by the seat of their pants, kind of. And in cases where people didn't have inherent competence, that was a bad deal. Where they had it, I mean, arguably it's better than today where everybody's overtrained for that, you know. I'm not sure where that all sets out, but there was a pretty wide range.
But was there, would you say that within the company or within these different groups that you were at that point, an attitude that that we want to do good things, that we want to be creative in some sense in solving these problems.
Always that. I mean, attention to the task, commitment to the enterprise, and affection for the company were pretty much universal. I don't recall ever having someone say, you know, why am I working for this blankety blank outfit? Did never see any of that. There was lots of commitment to the enterprise by everybody. I mean, their ability to execute varied, as I've said, but their level of commitment was universally darn good.
How much flexibility did you have as a young new recruit to the company? Or in terms of your input and ideas as opposed to somebody saying, this is what you should do?
It was very surprising to me, but the answer is lots of freedom. Lots of freedom, a lot of attention paid to ideas that I had, lots of maybe more than was deserved in some cases. But I did not ever feel a constraint in that context. I'm just surprisingly ready. One of Dow's great strengths, in my view, was its willingness to push decision-making down, to invite ideas to bubble up and not get too suppressed, and all of that. And I was working on a hot project. I was working on, for much of the time, my first full-time job was in using water-soluble polymers for oil recovery, as you sure know. And Mr. Doan had a personal interest in that and some other people. So it may be that I was in a somewhat unusual situation, but I always felt plenty of support, plenty of freedom, never a question with that, as long as I was kind of committed to stay in the research organization. Once I started to make sounds about wanting to go sell something, then we got a little different ballgame. But within research, they were fair to me, good to me, no complaints, lots of opportunity.
Ray Bondi has used the term accountable freedom.
Yeah, I think that's a good term. Yeah. It isn't as though we could all just go order what we want and do what we want. You know, accountable freedom is quite a good term for what I felt I had there. Yeah, I mean, for a young chemist, we may not have recognized it, but those had equal importance. On the accountable side, that's what makes you grow up and be a productive manager. The freedom side lets your creativity work for you. I like that a lot. Accountable freedom is a very good term.
Yeah, just as an aside, I was very fortunate to have two sessions with Ray a number of years ago.
I envy you that. He had that book. What was it? Yeah, it was a book about, it was a physics lab book, I guess. And I had a dinner for all of the people who contributed to chapters of that. And Ray was the guest of honor at that dinner. Maybe I thought that idea up. I said, let's just have a nice dinner. And Ray came, and Sylvia Stacer came. Mm-hmm.
We talked to her.
Did you? You got her.
Ned and I.
Terrific.
Spent a couple hours with her, and she was delightful.
Oh, wonderful woman. And it may be that was her last kind of public thing, that dinner that I had. So I was very pleased with that.